Friday in the off season of college football, and we need to have some of those off season conversations. I think we got a good one today, because joining us is Scott Dockerman from The Athletic. He covers Iowa for us. He's covered Iowa and the Big Ten for a long time, and he had a really interesting column that ranked all of the Big Ten football coaching hires, so 40 of them since Kirk Ferentz. And Kirk Ferentz is also included. So basically all of them since 1999. And it's a very fascinating list. And a little bit of newsworthiness to it, because one of the guys who made three of the hires, and also one of the guys who was outgoing for one of the hires, is Barry Alvarez, who retired this week at Wisconsin. So Scott, how much fun was this list to put together, and how much anger have you gotten, because it's been out for a few days? I mean, how many people are, you got Pat Fitzgerald too low, or Kirk Ferentz shouldn't be up there? What are you most getting roasted for?
Oh, thanks for having me on. And yeah, you can expect it's one of those things where how many times do you want to dip your toe into the comment section, you know, just so you can, you know, get a pie thrown in your face. And I would say this has been a really interesting experience, because I went through, as you said, you know, 22 years worth of Big Ten hires. And I think once you get past the middle teens, there's such a drop off. And I think a lot of the blowback I've gotten relate more to the polarizing coaches of the era. Jim Harbaugh. You look at his statistics, I mean, you know, 49 and 22 in the Big Ten, 34 and 16 in the Big Ten. He's had the numbers to put him in the top 10 without any problems, but he hasn't done the two things that you're required to do at Michigan: beat Ohio State and win the Big Ten title. So that always pushes him down.
And there's a curve to it too, right? Success at Northwestern equals more than success at Michigan, because you're supposed to win at Michigan. You're not supposed to win at Northwestern, although Pat Fitzgerald has made it where he kind of is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at numbers 3 through 5, Mark D'Antonio, Kirk Ferentz, and Pat Fitzgerald. None of them are at that blue blood level, but they're able to compete at a blue blood level, and, you know, outside of Ohio State, which is now far and away the flagship institution of the Big Ten. So the fact that, you know, D'Antonio was able to win 3 Big Ten titles and win another division title over a short period of time. Kirk Ferentz has 7 top 15 finishes, all with different quarterbacks. Northwestern is it has more disadvantages than any other team in the league. Location, you know, size of stadium, the recruiting base, the entrance exams, the history, and yet Pat Fitzgerald year in and year out has them, for the most part, sometimes they dip, but has them competitive and winning West Division titles. I think those are bigger accomplishments than strictly win-loss record that Harbaugh's compiled. And, you know, another one in that category to some extent is Brady Hoke. You know, Brady Hoke, 31 and 20, that's better than Tom Allen. That's better than PJ Fleck. Yet, you know, Brady Hoke didn't do what he was
also not at Indiana.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. The one that jumped out at me that I thought was interesting, and this almost feels like twisting the knife. You have Scott Frost at number 27 and Mike Riley at number 28.
Yes. You know, I went around and round, and I talked to our colleague Mitch Sherman about this, because I followed Nebraska very closely since they've joined the Big Ten. And you could make the case that Mike Riley's had a more successful career. He has a better record. He actually had a 9-win season. They were in the top 10 at one point before they completely, you know, flew down and fell out. But
that may have been a function of schedule more than
right.
anything else.
Yeah, it was too, no doubt. Because I saw him that year also lose 40-10 in the season finale. But he's also the one that put that blew up Nebraska, that put them in the crater that they were, that went 4-8. And I think they allowed five or six of their last opponents to score 50 plus points. And Scott Frost is trying to dig out of that. And if you go with hires, if you even use that as a criteria, which I really didn't, but if you think about it, Scott Frost was a home run hire at the time. He was one of the most highly sought after coaches. He had a perfect season. You know, they won a quote unquote national championship in their eyes at Central Florida. And then next thing you know, he goes to Nebraska and they felt good about themselves. Now that has not translated well at all, but I still think he's had a little bit better run than Mike Riley, because that last year there, they were like ice under a Zamboni. It was terrible.
Oh, well, so we're going to get to Barry Alvarez in a bit, because I find his tenure fascinating in terms of trying to hire the next best version of Barry. And I think finally doing very well and succeeding ultimately at that. But your number one and number two interest me, because it's one of those hypotheticals that I think back to pretty frequently, that I wonder how things might have been different had this situation been different. So your number one is Urban Meyer at Ohio State, and your number two is Jim Tressel at Ohio State. Now, the thing I always wonder about, Scott, is what if Jim Tressel never replies to Chris Cicero's email? For those who don't remember, that's what got Jim Tressel run out at Ohio State. It wasn't the tattoo thing. It was that he was told about it. He acknowledged that he was told about it via email, but then they didn't do anything about it. And then when the NCAA investigators asked him about it, he lied to them. That's what got him run out. Mm-hmm. If he had just said, I didn't know about this, and there was no proof that he did, he's fine. He might still be the coach there. Yeah. He might not be a university president right now. But what I wonder is, would Ohio State be as good as it is? Because I don't think it would.
No, you're right. You watch those games and those championship games in 2006 and 2007, and even when they lost to Texas in the Fiesta Bowl in 08. There was a talent gap at Ohio State versus the other upper echelon teams in the country. And Ohio State, for what it was in when he got there, sure, he's an excellent coach. He has them fundamentally sound, disciplined, tough, but speed factor was not there. Ohio State had great players, but not enough of them. And they certainly couldn't cover the field against, you know, the SEC speed per se. And so I don't see them winning a national title. Maybe they get to a BCS championship game. Maybe they get to a college football playoff, but they're not beating Alabama in 2014. They're not going undefeated. They maybe even lose to Michigan, dare I say, once over the last 10 years if he's there.
That's where I think Harbaugh-Tressel as a Michigan-Ohio State matchup is probably a pretty fun, more even matchup. Maybe Ohio State still has the edge, but, you know, 2015 and 2016, when Harbaugh comes in like a ball of fire, I think there's more of a shot for Harbaugh and Michigan to win those. But that's the question is, where would Urban Meyer end up? Because I was under the impression before the Sandusky stuff went down that Urban was looking at Penn State, that he was considering maybe replacing Joe Paterno at Penn State. But then after that, and then also at that point, Tressel had happened, because, you know, that year that Urban Meyer is doing TV, the Tressel stuff happens over the summer, but as he's kind of plotting his next move, you don't know exactly what's going to happen at Ohio State yet. So does he do that? Does he stay in TV and wait for the USC job to open, which happened, I believe, in 2013. So it's interesting to think about how those things might, like, would Mac Brown have stepped aside gracefully if Urban Meyer was coming in at Texas? Because that might have happened.
Yeah, he was kind of like, at that point, I don't know if you remember, but he was like Jimmy Johnson after he left the Cowboys. And Don Shula was kind of waiting there. Everybody wanted Jimmy to take over for Don Shula with the Dolphins. And that's kind of the way I felt like with Urban Meyer at that point, which was, he won two national titles with Florida. He was the big fish out there. Somebody wanted him. And it turned out to be the most perfect situation for him to go back to his home state. They needed him. The Big Ten needed him, because we'd seen that decline. And there's a lot of pride in the Big Ten, just as much as there is in the SEC. And, you know, those two regions have, you know, kind of prided themselves against one another for, you know, several hundred years. But really what he was able to do, and it rankled feathers right away, but it was necessary, was to tell everybody in the Big Ten, you're not recruiting well enough. You need
he to blew up the gentleman's agreement.
Yes.
Remember Brett Bielema complaining about the gentleman's agreement?
Exactly.
You're not supposed to recruit committed players. And Urban Meyer's like, I've been in the SEC, home slices. Yeah. This is what they do.
Exactly. You know, I look at that as kind of as a league where everybody kind of crosses their legs and they get their coffee out and let's sit around and talk. And, you know, and that's the way it was before that. And he walked in and it's like, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. And we need to be better. And boom, they put together a team in 2014 and 15 that could compete against anybody. And they did.
Yeah.
And everybody had to change to get better. Michigan obviously said, we can't live with Brady Hoke anymore. And they got Harbaugh. Harbaugh hasn't been able to catch up, but at least they made that move. You know, with Penn State, it was a different situation, but they went out and got James Franklin, who's been really important. You've seen teams like,
and you have James Franklin ranked pretty high.
Yeah.
And I'm with you because he took over a really tough situation. And Bill O'Brien, for everything everybody says about Bill O'Brien as a Texans coach, he did a very good job at Penn State stabilizing that situation. That still doesn't mean it was good when James Franklin showed up. The sanctions hadn't been rolled back yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he takes the job, and within 2 years, he's winning a much, much better Big Ten than anybody had seen in the previous 10 years.
Without a doubt, you know, Bill O'Brien, nobody could have done what he did and be that bridge in 2012. I think it was, even though they were 8-4, that was maybe the most difficult gig that anybody's ever had in the Big Ten. And he was able to do it and do it successfully to bridge to James Franklin, to also bring that killer spirit recruiting wise and bravado that needed to happen at Penn State too, because it would kind of been languishing in the late end of the Paterno era. But, you know, that's what everything Urban brought, was it forced the Blue Bloods to make big hires. It also forced teams like Wisconsin to go to a 3-4, which it did under Dave Aranda. And that took their defense from being very good to elite. It forced Iowa to go from being a 4-3 with a 230-pound outside linebacker to a 4-2-5. And now it's one of the best defenses in the country. Why? Because it needs to cover people like Ohio State has. And it's changed the context of offense. So he is the biggest change agent in the Big Ten since Hayden Fry was there in the early 80s and broke up the Michigan-Ohio State cartel. And so and probably more so because he won national titles and outside of a few really inexplicable, crazy road losses, was unbeatable, frankly, in that league. So to your point, Tressel would still be number one, but I think you could have debates to say, is winning a national title once at Ohio State bigger than what D'Antonio did, bigger than what Ferentz did, or, you know, because some of those other coaches might have actually won a couple of titles, Big Ten titles at least.
And D'Antonio, I feel like D'Antonio and Bielema kept the league afloat the rest of the league. Obviously, Tressel was doing what he's doing at Ohio State. They're achieving at a very high level, but they have just all the natural advantages. But it did feel like D'Antonio and Bielema kept the rest of the league relevant during that period.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You know, that first championship game in 2011 was as fun of a game to ever watch. I mean, it went back and forth, came down to the very end, and you know, if Michigan State hadn't roughed the punter, they would have won and went on.
And remember, the regular season game between those two that year was pretty freaking awesome, too.
Yes, Hail Mary. I mean, it was an incredible run. We always kind of joke in this part of the world that Michigan State, Wisconsin, and Iowa are three polar bears fighting over the same sheet of ice, because they recruit the same players, they play the same styles. When they play, it's just a nasty fist fight and really physical. But when you look at D'Antonio, I think, you know, those 2 years, but especially 2013, which was the year Florida State and Auburn played, and they beat the shit out of Ohio State in that championship game. I mean, they really took it to them.
It was incredible because nobody thought they could do that. Now, mm-hmm. they would go and do that again in 2015 to a team that was probably even more talented.
Yeah.
But, the way they won, and I think that win forced Urban Meyer to to raise his game.
Yes.
I think that was him going, okay, I can't just walk over this league. These guys are going to fight back.
Yes. His defenses really set him apart. And that 13 team, they won all 10 Big Ten games, including the championship, by more than double figures. And I think there is a case to be made that maybe they actually deserved the berth in the BCS championship game that year, because they went in on and won the Rose Bowl. They beat Stanford in that incredible fourth down. And I mean, that is big boy football at its finest, that play. And, you know, where they gave it to the up back, and I think it was Ellsworth who ran over, jumped over the pile and stuffed him for 1 yard loss. And then in 15, the Iowa Michigan State game was, 22 play drive at the end.
That drive. And that was just bring a tear to the eye of the longtime Big Ten fans. And,
yes.
You know, as they're being dragged into this modern era, yes, they get this one beautiful moment where you see a 22 play drive for the team that was, now Michigan State had one loss. Iowa was undefeated. And then unfortunately it goes to get, you know, win the right to get destroyed by Alabama, but
or Stanford.
You get the beautiful moment, and then modern football comes back and says, "Nah, too bad."
Yeah.
So
exactly, you get Derrick Henry for Michigan State, you get Christian McCaffrey for Iowa, and both teams are going, "Hey, come on, we like big boy football." But you know, and that's where
Stanford played big boy football too. So that's not
right.
A totally unfair comparison. It is amazing though, the D'Antonio and Ferentz and Bielema / Paul Chris, that style of football has survived, and that's really the only place it survived.
Yeah, really. And D'Antonio had less success later on. I think once Michigan, established itself at least as a competitive program again under Harbaugh, that they started getting those recruits. Franklin started taking those recruits. Same thing with, you know, Urban. And it went down a little bit at Michigan State. And so you saw some blips. You know, they went 3-9 a year and really some surprising seasons. The Big Ten West is really where that style of play resides, simply and because, you know, talent isn't the number one factor there like it is everywhere else.
I find it interesting because the Big Ten West also has Northwestern, and we always look at Northwestern as kind of the plucky, you know, academic school, but Northwestern was always on the cutting edge offensively. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were back to the turn of this century. They were on the cutting edge offensively. They hit a dip in their offense. Their defense has been carrying them of late, but they're going to get better offensively now that they've made some changes. But that's the interesting thing is you had that dichotomy within the division, although that wasn't the division.
Yeah,
because you had leaders and legends to start with, and you had to figure out the M's and the N's. And I mean, this is, you think about all the stuff that's happened since Kirk Ferentz took over at Iowa, you know, the addition of three different schools, splitting into divisions two different ways. Jim Delaney is no longer the commissioner, which is a pretty big deal. The new commissioner having maybe the worst first year ever. Yeah. But it is. And here's Kirk Ferentz who, you know, it was looking pretty dicey for Kirk Ferentz about this time last year.
Yeah.
And it was. So he jettisons Chris Doyle, but it seems, at least from reading the report where they interviewed a whole lot of stakeholders in the Iowa program, players, parents, you name it, that Kirk Ferentz came out okay on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I didn't know that he'd be willing to make the amount of changes that he's made.
Yeah. That's been the key factor is his humility, I think, is probably what sets him apart from most coaches, because he's willing at that point to look inward. And the very first day he described it as very tough, but he called anybody and everybody who had played for him, who knew him, black, white, but just, hey, tell me what you think, and I don't care what it is. I need to know it, even if it hurts. And he got a lot of information that, yeah, it wounded him. But he also realized, and he told me this directly right after everything settled, was I had two choices. I'm old enough. I could retire. I could sit there and go, right. Okay, I had a great career.
He could build a castle in Iowa City and
exactly. You know, he has one
really deep moat if he wanted to.
Exactly. So. Right. But he's like, or I could make things better and right. And that's what I chose to do. And that's kind of the way he's been. I mean, he walked in his first year at Iowa. He was 0-8 in the Big Ten. 4 years later, he's 8-0. He's a fixer. He's a builder. He wants to make things better. He does have a lot of support from people. And through, hundreds of conversations on and off record last year, that was one of the key factors that everybody kind of told me, that even people who were angry and upset and wanted change, they believed he was capable of doing it and he was a good guy. They weren't that way about Doyle and a few other coaches, even the few assistants who stayed, but they were about him and he deserved the right to change it, even if they're skeptical it could. Well, he did. He looked inward. He made changes. And the players and their parents, who I check in with on a frequent basis just to make sure we're not missing anything, all say it's so much better now because they feel like they could be themselves. And that was something he wanted to be, the militaristic guy, and he was. It wasn't the style anymore, and he needed to make that change, and he did. And last year, by the end of the year in the Big Ten, you know, they were pretty good. They were as good as they've been in a long time.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because they start off with the two kind of fluky losses, and then you kind of see what they are, and they're very consistent the rest of the way. I was interested to see, you know, they were supposed to play Michigan that final week. That mm-hmm. would have been pretty interesting comparison, but I wonder, thinking back on the changes they made and the stuff that was going on that caused the problems in the first place, how many recruits did they miss out on because there was bad word of mouth about the program?
There's some, and really their biggest rival in recruiting was probably Michigan State with D'Antonio. And there were, right. was some bad blood over the years because they both recruit Chicago and the suburbs really, really hard. And so that was being used against them. There was one program in the West that said, we will not use this against you. Others did. But I think the biggest problem Iowa had was, and I'm sure you probably from 30,000 feet saw kind of at times a very stale program, nothing, you know, kind of bland. They're 7-5. They'd win games they should. They lose other games. And that was kind of in the early part of the decade. And a lot of that, what I wondered was they would recruit good players, but then they would leave. And there was so much, and this was kind of Chris Doyle. He would put so much equity into the players that worked hard in the weight room. And a lot of times those were the try hard guys, and yeah. they would get the start because it was his word was so outsized that it's like, oh, okay, well, if this guy is really busting ass in the weight room, then he's, you know, his hard work trumps that guy's talent. That guy with talent would leave. And then they would have the try hard, do everything right. But he's not covering Saquon Barkley in the flat as the week.
Well, exactly. You know who always said this, as long as I've covered him, who always said the try hard guys are nice, but I'll take the five stars mm-hmm. was Urban Meyer. Mm-hmm.
he
appreciated there's a place for the try hard guys in the program, but he'll still take Percy Harvin.
Yes.
You know, he'll still take Zeke Elliott. Those are the guys you need to win titles. So that I did wonder about that with Iowa, but let's talk about fixers who used to, another mm-hmm. fixer who used to work for Hayden Fry. Yeah. And that's Barry Alvarez. He goes to Wisconsin, revives that program in the 90s. If you haven't read Jesse Temple's story yeah. about the untold stories of Barry Alvarez's tenure at Wisconsin, please go read it. It's on The Athletic. It is a wonderful kind of encapsulation of who mm-hmm. this guy, and he's a character. The one that stuck with me, Scott, was the second year. They're 5-5 going to the mm-hmm. last game. And they lose on it's just a crushing yeah. loss. They fumble and lose the ball and the game's over. And so they were going to go to a bowl game, but now they're not. And Barry is just furious in the locker room, but he hasn't talked to the players yet. This is just sort of privately. And then he goes to address the players and he's not furious anymore. And he says, you seniors, I'm sorry, but when we go to the Rose Bowl, you're all getting watches. Mm-hmm. Like that's the thing. Like, you knew that this guy knew mm-hmm. he could make this happen. He could make it work.
he's the biggest swinging guy walking in the room anywhere he goes.
Right.
You know when he's in there, he kind of carries himself that way. I mean, you know, whether it's sandals without socks and Big Ten media days.
Wait. I realize it's a big, maybe this is a Big Ten thing.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to wear sandals with socks, Scott. That's bad.
Yeah, but he's in his 70s.
Take it from down here in sandal country. You don't wear socks with them.
I would blind people if I wore sandals. That was the thing with Barry. He was just, he walked in, he was a presence. He liked himself. You know it. But how many people could legitimately transfer from being a Hall of Fame coach with his resume to being the AD and hiring people that continue your success in the same manner and not get ego in the way? That was impressive.
But how many ADs say do it like I did if they're ex-coaches and it actually works?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the other thing that's crazy. Like, you only listen to Barry because it worked.
Yeah.
Like, usually if you're the coach, you don't listen to the AD when they're like, in my day, but everything Barry did still worked.
Exactly.
So I think it's what he did as the coach was one of the best jobs of establishing an identity for a program that anybody's ever done. Mm-hmm. What he did as an AD was one of the best jobs of continuing that identity without break. Like, 'cause everybody eventually says I can do better. Like, mm-hmm. And this is the Big Ten folks probably don't remember this at all, but when Georgia Southern, back when they were still in the FCS, mm-hmm. hired Brian Van Gorder, and he's like, I'm not going to do that stupid triple option stuff. Like, no, you're Georgia Southern. You run the triple option. It's what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
and that's what Barry, he created this identity that allows Wisconsin to be competitive year after year, and then found people who are willing to recruit to that identity and coach that identity.
And to his credit, two out of the three coaches he hired were assistants for him and understood it. They're from that part of the world, so they knew how to translate it. Bielema, what kind of a breeding ground did he come from? I mean, he played for Fry, he coached with Fry and Ferentz, Bill Snyder, Barry Alvarez, and then becomes the head coach. So he's got a mix of all of that, and he understood what worked. Still used the big power O, pin and pull. You know, he had big running backs, the works. And then, you know, Gary Anderson was kind of a weird little hiccup in the middle because he actually changed the defense. And Paul Christ, to his credit, and I mean, he doesn't, I know he has an ego, but he doesn't show it, because here he is with Barry over his shoulder and he's really unassuming. But then he's also willing to say, you know what, we're not going to go back to that 4-3. We're going to use the 3-4. And what we've seen is such a better defense. And that's all, you know, even though the scheme is different, but it really goes back to Barry about playing great defense, run fits, things.
It also fits into what they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to have a really good even front defense, you have to be able to recruit certain types.
Mm-hmm.
Like that Clemson 2018 defensive line.
Right.
Like, you had to be able to recruit that to win national titles running an even front defense. And you're Wisconsin, you're never going to be able, like, you will never be able to get consistently the 6'5", 265-pound, lightning-fast defensive end,
mm-hmm.
or the 6'3", 295-pound cat quick three technique. Like, you're just not always going to have that guy. With an odd front, you can mix and match quite a bit more. You can find a tweener who can rush the passer. You can disguise where that fourth rusher is coming from. And I think you've seen that with the Aranda defenses and with mm-hmm. Jim Leonard since he's been there.
Yeah. And the other factor is, again, kind of that three polar bears, one sheet of ice. Iowa and Michigan State under D'Antonio, they were 4-3. That's how they recruited. They always fought over the same players. This blew it up to where, let's just get guys who control the line of scrimmage in two gap and as a 30 front. And then they get, you know, ass kickers on the edge, you know, 3-4 guys who there's no spot for in Iowa's defense or Michigan State's defense for a 6'4", 235-pound guy because you're not going to play him in space. And you're going to, but in their case, they're going to put him off the edge because he's not big enough to play a, you know, a strong end for either one of those other teams. And lo and behold, they have been so much better. And you know, Joe Schobert, I mean, the list goes on, and TJ Watt, you know, and JJ was a great 4-3 end, but he probably would have been an even better monster as the 3-4 end with the back.
Well, yeah, because he's athletic enough to be that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even at his size. Yeah, it's really interesting just how well they've been able to do that. And the Gary Anderson thing is the weird hiccup that, you know, I don't necessarily put that on Barry. Mm-hmm. Because Anderson decided he wanted to go back to the West Coast. He had issues with various things, which one of the issues was the same thing that Chase Bealum off, which was paying assistance, that sort of thing. Yeah. It does seem like they've gotten better on that front. I mean, nobody in the Big Ten can cry poor anymore, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't even wash because everybody in the Big Ten makes a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's why you see even mid to low level programs like Jeff Brohm paying $5 million a year. I mean, Purdue paying Jeff Brohm $5 million a year, but yeah, that was a big factor, was paying assistance. But even more was, you know, Wisconsin has rigid academic standards and how it brings in players. And, you know, Gary Anderson did a really nice job competing against Bielema when he was the coach at Ohio or at Utah State. And that's what endeared him to Barry, and then Barry kind of wanted him to stay within the box that worked, and he did. But you know, 2 years in, you know, he makes that move, and you know, right after they got pounded 59-0, but by Ohio State. But you know, Paul Chryst would have been that hire had he not left for Pittsburgh as the head coach. So it would have been a smooth transition to Paul Chryst. And then it was after a 2-year blip, but I think that was probably the factor why there wasn't a continuation. And then Paul's done a remarkable job and, you know, of maintaining it, because you could see different parts where things could dip permanently, and he's never allowed it to happen.
One of the all-time great closing lines was Barry Alvarez's press conference announcing his retirement the other day. If anybody needs me to come back to coach a bowl game, I'm available. Which is, I mean, because that was always the thing, is, oh, Barry just wants to be the coach again. Yeah. And then Anderson leaves and Barry gets to be the coach again and wins a bowl game.
Yes. It's the best. Yeah. That he you know, because he did that with Brett left after they beat Nebraska. 70-31 in the Big Ten title game. Brett leaves for Arkansas. He goes in and coaches the Rose Bowl. And, you know, Wisconsin's not even ranked because they were the third best team in the leaders division that year, because Ohio State and Penn State were ineligible. And he goes out there, they lose a close game. He loved being on the sidelines, loved being Barry for that one game. But then getting that chance in that 14 game. And that was as important, I think, the Ohio State Alabama game in the semifinals that year was the most important game in the Big Ten in 20 plus years, and probably throughout this whole duration, if I made a games. But I think a runner up or a footnote that's important was the Wisconsin Auburn game that Barry won, because I know Urban has said that before. When he saw that Wisconsin could beat Auburn, he went, okay, we have a chance here against Bama. And, you know, Melvin Gordon had a great game as always, but that was important to kind of solidifying the Big Ten, the next phase where, hey, this isn't a laughing stock, old fashioned league here. This isn't the Spanish Empire, you know, in the Spanish American War getting knocked off for good.
Well, I also don't think that now that Barry's gone, that like Paul Chryst isn't going to suddenly shift to running the air raid.
No,
like, no, that identity has been set. I think everybody understands now that's what works there. Now that may have to change. And as you've talked about, it did change defensively. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the offense has to change as the years go on. But I do think Chryst understands it well enough that they're not going to do anything radical, drastic. I mean, this team wasn't in the Big Ten at the time, but it has affected it since it's been in the Big Ten. The switch from Frank Solich to Bill Callahan at Nebraska, where you basically abandon all that made you special. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just, you can't do that. You have to be very careful, because when you have something that works, you can't throw it out, you know, baby in the bathwater. You have to you have to preserve some of that. And so I think Wisconsin's done a great job of that.
Yeah. And I think the identity part, and if there are three programs that know what they are and they'll never change from that, it's Wisconsin, Northwestern, and Iowa, because they have their solidified head coaches. They understand their recruiting region. And that is, in the upper Midwest, it's easier to go find 6'5", 300 pounds and mm-hmm. use that to your advantage rather than find 4'3" speed. You just don't find it very regularly. Nebraska has not been able to compete at a line of scrimmage level with those teams. That's why Iowa's beaten them 6 times in a row, Wisconsin 8 times in a row, that they've, other than a win against Purdue, they had they've lost their last most recent game against every West Division team. They have no identity. That's the problem with Nebraska. If they went back and said, let's make our primary tenets to solidify the offensive line, play kick-ass run defense, and then worry about whether you run zone read or pro style, you know, that's secondary. Just block people and tackle them and force them to move. That's all they have to do. And then I tell that to Nebraska fans all the time. Look, you don't have to aspire to be Wisconsin or Iowa, but you have to compete with them along the line of scrimmage or you're going to be where you are. And that has not changed under the Riley Frost era.
Right. And those are all still players you can find, but you have to develop them. You can't plug them and play them. There's not going to be a bunch of guys like that you can bring in as true freshmen that are going to make a difference. They're going to have to be in your program for a while and work there, which is interesting because like that wasn't what Scott Frost dealt with at Oregon.
Yeah.
That wasn't what Scott Frost dealt with it at UCF. This is a different environment. Now, Scott Frost obviously knows it because he's been there, but it is interesting how much people forget that you cannot just plug and play the big guys.
Yeah.
Unless you're recruiting down south and recruiting really well down south. Those are the only times you're getting ready to play defensive tackles and ready to play offensive guards and offensive tackles. Just otherwise, you gotta work on it.
Yeah, no matter where you live in this part of the world, you're not going to find Derrick Brown. You're not going to find Landon Dickerson off the street. You know, you can make them. You can make players that good, but it takes time. And, and then when you're going against kind of diverse blocking schemes, I mean, Wisconsin's, pin and pull gap style is really difficult if you don't know your technique, if you don't watch it, if you're not disciplined every single down. Iowa's, zone scheme.
Also, forget the discipline part on Wisconsin. I mean, you just have to be willing to get dump trucked a bunch.
Yeah.
And understand that that's your job as a D lineman.
Yeah.
And you got to try to stalemate and let that linebacker make a play. And exactly. It's really hard. It's really hard to tell somebody, listen, you're not going to get any glory this game. You're just going to get the crap kicked out of you. But hopefully you get the crap kicked out of you slowly enough that the linebackers can come up and make the tackle.
Exactly.
So, yeah. It's something. Now I want to ask you this about Iowa, because they do have a very defined identity. And obviously Kirk Ferentz has been the architect of that. He's not going to coach forever. Mm-hmm. The start of your list is his hire in 1999. He is the longest tenured head coach. And what's crazy is he's been the longest tenured head coach since Bob Stoops retired 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the gap just keeps growing. Mm-hmm. But do you think when he does hang it up, that Iowa hangs on to that identity?
I don't think it's as I don't think there's as much of a baton handoff as there is with Wisconsin and Barry to Bielema to Crist on down, because it really depends on who replaces him. And I don't know that there is somebody on staff that will take that baton immediately. You know, Brian Ferentz has always been discussed as a successor, but he's really kind of a polarizing figure. And and that's just all along, hey, he's Ferentz's kid. So he's been developing as an offensive coordinator, but can he take it? And Kirk said last summer to me, look, I don't know if that he really wants it. And some of his best assistants, Phil Parker, especially, who I think is really undervalued. He doesn't really want to be a head coach. He's kind of figured out is the Peter principle. I like coaching people. I don't like being a CEO. And so some of the older assistants aren't really there. So I think where they go is probably somebody who understands the landscape of Iowa and the style that wins. I don't think they're going to say, hey, let's go out and get Rich Rodriguez and have him run his style of offense at Iowa. That's a disaster. But I think it's somebody who understands, look, it's going to be line of scrimmage football. Maybe they switch from the zone blocking, you know, I'm going to race you to this spot. And then when I get there, I'm going to bury you and put, you know, every single ounce of body on your chest versus it might be more gap style, or maybe it might be, an 11 personnel more often than not. But I don't think that they'll ever get away from what makes this area work. If they try to get to a pass heavy scheme that relies on, a lot of misdirection or, you know, receivers, then you're going to get what you got with Greg Davis, which was just the most horrific combination of offenses that you'll ever see.
So basically what you're saying is they're going to hire Matt Campbell. I only say that just to tick off the Iowa State fans, because they're always mad because I'm saying Matt Campbell is going to leave. He's going to go somewhere else. He's not leaving to go to Iowa. No, don't worry about that.
That one won't happen, but no, that would rock the world here. There's no doubt about that.
No, but it is interesting because you're right. The identity is so thoroughly defined. The idea of somebody else doing it, you know, would they change and would that work? I think because we're talking, when we talk about Wisconsin and Northwestern and Iowa, we're talking about programs near their ceilings almost all the time. And, you know, it's not the same as like when we say Auburn underachieves. Mm-hmm. Like if Auburn underachieves, it's because we know they can bring in the kind of talent that allows them to compete for national titles. But these programs, if they're competing for a national title, it's because there's a really special set of circumstances. And they've had this just probably an unbelievable recruiting class 4 years ago and this amazing set of seniors and then they've recruited really well beneath them. It's not the same at the traditional, like the perennial national title contenders aren't like that. They just go get some guys and
yeah,
when they get the right chemistry, they win. And so I think that's what's interesting is to think how risky it is when you do have to make a hire at a place like that, because you run the risk of losing what makes you special, and you have to be very careful with that. So we'll see what happens, but Kirk Ferentz still humming along at Iowa, yeah. and Paul Chryst carrying the Barry torch for quite a bit longer at Wisconsin. So
yeah,
Scott, thank you so much.
Yeah. Oh, it's been fun. I always like talking offensive line football. So, I like,
oh, absolutely. What beers are we cracking on a Friday night, by the way?
I've got two in my fridge. You know, I've got the Polecat Porter, which is from Back Pocket Brewing here in town, or Big Grove, I should say. And that's named after the play. I don't know if you saw this, the Ohio State Iowa game 4 years ago, where Iowa, you know, shocked the world. Well, the fake field goal where the snapper caught the ball and then tripped up at the 1 yard line. Well, that fake field goal was called Polecat. So then they named this beer the nice. Polecat Porter. So I do have that in my fridge and I have a few spotted cows left too. So, for my last trip to Wisconsin.
Have one in honor of Barry Alvarez.
I will. And, always do.
I like the porters and the stouts. I'm a big dark fan. Mm-hmm. I think for me that the new discovery has been, Oyster City Hooter Brown, which is a brown ale out of Apalachicola, Florida. Apalachicola, where they get the oysters in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a very famous restaurant called Boss Oyster where you go and they'll make oysters 18 billion different ways there. But yeah, they make a really good brown ale, and they also have a mango pale ale called Mangrove that's really good. So nice. If you are in the grocery store, if you're in a Hy-Vee in Iowa, mm-hmm. or if you're in a Publix in Florida, you can pick yourself up some of that.
I'm going to have to. I'll have to give that a shot now. Now that we've got deck weather in Iowa, it's finally exactly here. Right. You know, not 35. Right. So,
oh, well, I didn't want to think about that. Yeah, we're going. We've had one day in the 90s already, and we're not far from every day in the 90s. It'll be probably another month before we hit that, but it's coming. So it's going to be lighter beer season.
Okay. Yeah, we've had a lot of, when it hits about after freezing 32 degrees, then that's when we start to grill, just because it's finally you can get outside, you know. And now we've had a couple 70 degree days this week. So it's also lawn mowing season. So kick back, watch some Masters, have a beer, you know, put on my.
Yeah, I got sod laying season over with last week, so I don't have to mow it for a while.
Okay. Put on the Air Dads, the Air Monarchs, and fire that's away exactly on the yard. Yeah.
All right. Scott Docterman, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Andy.